Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Members of the millennial generation are now at the age when Americans typically purchase their first home. But this particular group of young adults faces unique challenges. Coming of age in the shadow of the recession may have affected their finances and their outlook on housing as a good investment. On top of that, many carry high student loan debts and all face tough competition in the starter home market from downsizing baby boomers. Today in The Exchange, millennial home ownership, what this large number of potential home buyers wants and needs, and whether they're able to get it. Let's hear from you, especially if you're of this generation or have millennial young adult children. What's your view of this topic? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org, or use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We're going to begin with the national picture, and joining us for that is Lori Goodman, co-director of the Housing Finance Policy Center at the Urban Institute, which has studied millennial home ownership. She joins us from D.C. And Lori, a big welcome. Thank you for your time.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
So first off, just real quick, Lori, how do you define who's in this generation and who isn't? Because I keep seeing conflicting definitions.
Yes, so we define millennial as those born between 1981 and 1997. In fact, the definition is arbitrary. There's no universal definition of this group, and they're oftentimes referred to as Gen Y or Echo Boomers. Some date the group as early as 1977. Others date the beginning of this group as late as 19, some date as early as 1977, others as late as 1982. The end of the group as early as 1994, as late as 2004. But we use 1981 to 1997.
Wow, okay.
In fact, the only group with an official definition is the baby boomers, which are those born between 1946 and 64. None of the other generations have an official definition, and there's a lot of fuzziness.
Well, right. And I looked up a couple of those definitions and found similarly to you. But in general, Lori, we're talking about young adults, you know, mid-20s to mid-30s. Is that right?
Yes.
So your organization published a study on millennial home ownership. Really interesting, Lori, finding that the rate was 8 percentage points lower than the two previous generations when they were at the same age. So we're comparing apples to apples here. What do you think the most significant factors are there, Lori?
I think sort of the two most significant factors is the delay in major life events, for example, getting married and having kids. So in 1990, 34% of 18 to 34-year-olds were never married. That number was 54% in 2017. The second major factor is this generation has a lot greater diversity in terms of race and ethnicity. In 1990, 76% of the 18 to 34-year-olds were white. That was down to 60% by 2017. But then there are other factors that are play a contributing role, including credit availability. The median score of mortgage borrowers is about 730. The median score of millennials is about 640.
What does that mean, Lori? Sorry to interrupt, but yeah, I'm not really sure what that
means. Credit score, usually your FICO score in particular, is a critical variable in being able to get a mortgage. It basically looks at how well you pay your bills, and you're sort of graded on a scale from 300 to 800. So 730 is sort of the median for all home buyers, whereas millennials are much, much lower, and a lot of them, you know, haven't established sort of traditional credit at all.
Interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
Student loan debt is very, very important. And student loan debt is particularly important for those who don't graduate college, because if you graduate college, you have the higher earnings that result from that. But if you don't graduate college, you've got the debt without the higher earnings. So it's it produces a very, very negative relationship for home ownership and actually for a lot of other things in life, too.
So greater racial diversity means lower levels of home ownership because non-Hispanic whites have the highest home ownership levels. So the more diverse a generation, Lori, statistically, it just means there'll be fewer homeowners. That's just the way the numbers shake out. Delayed marriage and childbearing, typical incentives to buy a home. Young adults these days are doing it later. Student loan debt, you talked about that. I also read, Lori, about just higher rents these days making it harder to save for that down payment. Have you found that?
Higher rents make it, yes. Oh, yes, definitely. Higher rents make it much harder to save for the down payment. Although there's a misconception as to how much down payment you actually need. There are a lot of people who think you need 20% down to buy a house. In fact, you need like 3.5% down or 3% down to buy a house. But certainly higher rents. And then also there is very little sort of affordable housing supply.
Yeah, and we'll definitely talk about that with our New Hampshire guests about the incredibly tight housing supply here in the Granite State. Another thing that jumped out at me from your report, Lori, it mentions a slight attitudinal change toward home ownership with this generation. What is that attitudinal change?
So for my generation, and I'm a boomer, home ownership was the way to build value. You didn't take vacations for years so that you could save for your first home. You didn't go out to dinner so that you could save for the first home because home ownership was viewed as a store of value. For the millennial generation that lived through the Great Recession, it's really hard for them to see home ownership in that way. So, you know, they'll take vacations that their parents never dreamed of, and saving for a home just becomes a little bit less important in terms of being a store of value. They view it as a place to live. But, you know, for my generation, it was both a place to live and a store of value.
Well, we got an email from Paul who writes, I find that millennials value mobility over stability. Renting their primary home allows them the flexibility to move for the next job. Paul also says, oddly, as a realtor in a vacation market, I have sold second homes to millennials who rent in the city. Paul says, making an investment in real estate without being tied down. So what about that? Paul says he's seen millennials value mobility over stability.
That second point is very interesting. So the mobility point is largely a fiction in the sense that this generation is actually less mobile at the same age than my generation was.
Oh, wow, that's really interesting.
So when you look, they might value the perceived flexibility, but it's not exercised. But yes, you are actually seeing, but the second point is very well taken. You do see actually people, particularly in high-cost cities, who rent and who rent themselves and then own a home that they do not live in.
One last question for you, Lori. Why do you think it matters if this generation has lower home ownership rates than earlier generations, just looking out long-term?
I think actually for two reasons. Home ownership is the best single way to build wealth. When you look at people's wealth, a lot of it comes through the value of their home. And then you sort of say, well, why is that? I mean, home ownership is essentially an inflation hedge. When you buy a home, you essentially take out a 30-year fixed rate mortgage and lock the single largest expense of home ownership, your mortgage payment. Yes, property and taxes and maintenance can go up over time, but I mean, essentially, your largest payment is locked and it can only go down if you prepay your mortgage. By contrast, if you rent, your rent is going to go up every year and it's going to go up more in inflationary times. So what that allows you to do is save more easily and build wealth, plus your home is likely to go up in value over time as well.
So this is a broader
concern.
Provide
for your financial future.
Sure. Well, Lori, it's been good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Take care. Bye.
That's Lori Goodman, co-director of the Housing Finance Policy Center at the Urban Institute, which, as we heard, has studied millennial home ownership. And as we talk about millennial home ownership trends here in New Hampshire, I'm joined in the studio by Ryan Vizda, realtor in Concord, co-owner and founder of the Vizda team with Keller Williams. She also serves on the New Hampshire Businesses for Social Responsibility Advocacy Committee and the Stay at Work Play Advocacy Committee. And Ryan, it's really nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Nick Reagan, realtor in Bedford with the On the Move Realty Group, which is also part of Keller Williams. And Nick, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Laura.
And also with us, Heather McCann, director of housing research at the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority. And Heather, welcome. Good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Laura.
Well, Ryan, I want to start with you. As you listen to Lori discuss her research on millennial homebuyers from the Urban Institute, kind of giving us the national picture, what's your perspective here in the state? What do you hear from the younger people that you interact with, Ryan?
It echoes exactly what she's saying. I definitely have clients that rent in Concord, and they have second or their first home is in the mountains that they're renting on Airbnb. I have clients that are soon-to-be clients that are living in shared living situations where they're paying anywhere from $600 to $900 a month to share a room, like a room in a shared living situation, to save money for a down payment. And then people that are looking to either make that first purchase an investment purchase, or there also seems to be a sense that people want their independence and their freedom and to live a little bit more in the rural areas with more privacy and more control over their land. So that's a very the millennial buyers have a diverse range of things that they're looking for. And so I think people think that they want mobility, but they actually want to build wealth and find that place that's their own.
That's interesting. And what you said just goes to show that you can't generalize about a huge generation of people. You said that some of the millennials you work with want their own land, peace and quiet. What I hear time and time again is millennials want to be close to urban centers, to be able to walk to work or not have long commutes. So maybe you just can't generalize about what people want.
You can't, because I'll sit down with a first-time homebuyer and they say, I don't want to see my neighbors. I don't want to see, I want to be able to grow my own food. And then I will sit down with another young person. They'll be like, I want to walk everywhere.
Yeah.
I don't want to use my car. So yeah, there is no generalization.
Nick, what aspects of what we just heard, again, from the Urban Institute, particularly resonate for you working as a young realtor here in the Grand State?
Okay, so Ryan had some great points about, I see a lot of people that want, they want to be out in nature. They don't want to see their neighbors. Everything that she said, I completely agree with. A couple of things just I wrote down here while she was speaking that I wanted to just go over is the no credit. She said, young millennials aren't establishing credit. And what I find, when I get one of these millennial buyers that comes through, say, an open house or something, and I'm talking to them, they're like, well, I don't have 20% down to put on this house. And it's like, so you have to explain to them, well, you actually don't necessarily need 20%. The only thing that 20% does is it takes away your principal mortgage insurance, the insurance that you're going to pay on your mortgage over the course of the loan.
Where does that myth come from, the 20% down?
Honestly, I have no idea. I think it's just like their parents had told them, maybe previous generations, things were different. I don't know. I'm a millennial myself, so I wasn't involved in real estate back when my parents were buying a home. And I don't even think that went back when they bought, they put 20% down. So I PMI, principal mortgage insurance, has been around for a while. So I think it's just some kind of myth that, just kind of still is out there in the world. And then that kind of was just my next topic, is the down payment is just that people just, they don't necessarily, in some areas, in New Hampshire, a lot of areas qualify for no down payment.
So it's intimidating.
It is very intimidating, because the topic that was brought up before is the high rents. They don't have the extra money every month to be putting, $1,000 a month aside for, what they think is like 2 or 3 years to be able to afford this house. And, the biggest advice that I give to people that are first-time homebuyers and they're first looking and they're afraid is you want to just talk to a professional. We're all professionals, real estate agents, loan officers, we're all professionals. So we just, if you come to us with bad credit, it's nothing to be afraid of. It's something you can always change. It's not a permanent thing. You might have something on there that you got to work on. It's not a big deal. And then, and us as real estate agents working with first-time homebuyers is just education. Us educating them on, okay, cool. You want to be able to grow your own land? Well, here's what, or grow your own food on your own land. Well, here's kind of what you can be looking at is these kinds of price points and things like that. And, you can turn to the internet so much for advice, but turning to a professional is always great.
You know, Heather, I'd love to hear from you, too. And lots of interesting stuff there, Nick, that I definitely want to follow up on. But, Heather, what is your research here in the Granite State shown about New Hampshire young adult homebuyers?
Well, we typically focus on, when we think of young adult homebuyers and first-time homebuyers, we always look at the data, and we're really looking at homes that are in the under 300,000 range. And so when looking at that kind of cohort of listings and prices, it's been shrinking over time. So not only has inventory been shrinking in New Hampshire, but the amount of homes that are available under that $300,000 price range are very difficult to come by. And when you do come by them, they're gone very quickly. And so it's really tough for people, like Nick said, who have questions on how to buy things and maybe aren't as confident in just making an offer right away, to be aggressive in a market where you actually have to be aggressive and know what you want. And then they're also competing with older people that maybe are looking to downsize and buy these homes that are in that same price point that are maybe, you know, these smaller homes. And so they have more liquid assets, and so they are very hard to compete against. So it's difficult.
So how much do you think? It sounds like both. How much is price the problem? And how much is it supply for Granite State millennials?
So for May, we have a median purchase price of about $284,000. So half the homes on the market are above that, half are below. For June listings, we're down 10% from June last year. So
down 10%. So there's 10% fewer homes for sale.
Right. And so that's driving the price up. And so it's making it, you know, very difficult. We also look at as a gauge to see how quickly homes are going off the market, an absorption rate. So if we weren't to add any more inventory, how long it would take to sell off what's on the market. And so we're at about 4.5 months statewide. But when you get down to some counties in the lower part of the state, it gets even more aggressive. So Hillsborough is at about a 3.5 month absorption rate. And then it gets even smaller when you're looking at those homes under 300,000, it's about 3 months.
Wow. So looking at statewide numbers is useful, but you need to look at them with the proper lens because the picture varies from around the state.
Exactly.
Do you want to jump in, Ryan?
Yeah, the other challenge is that an under $300,000 home is not move-in ready. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at some type of major improvement that might have to be done. A lot of our inventory in New Hampshire can be a couple hundred years old. Mm-hmm. So not only is there the issues with caring for an older home, there could be a heating system, a roof, the peeling paint. So you're buying this large asset and then you're putting $15,000 of work into it to make it livable. So that's also a challenge that younger people are facing when they're going to purchase that home.
So you see on a website, you know, oh, it's in my price range. And then you go look at it and, you know, you got to tack on another $20,000 just to make it livable.
Correct.
Wow. That's an important point to make. What do you think about the mismatch that Heather described, Ryan, between what millennial homebuyers want and what's available to them? Again, you know, it's not just price, it's supply.
It's also the supply is huge because that's driving the price, and there's a lack of new construction because the cost to build is expensive, and because we're in such low inventory rates and absorption rates, land is expensive. So land is expensive. Building is expensive. And then we have this mentality in New Hampshire of not in my backyard. I don't want that new development. I don't want that workforce housing. I don't want that affordable housing, which is then making it difficult for people to build.
All right. A lot more to talk about after a short break. Join us as we continue our conversation on millennial homebuyers here in New Hampshire. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. What are your questions, comments, and of course, personal experiences with this topic? 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, why millennials are less likely to be homeowners than previous generations were at the same age. There are many factors at work, as we're hearing, especially a tight supply of smaller, more affordable homes in New Hampshire. What's your take on this issue? Are fewer millennials not buying because they can't afford it, or because the homes on the market aren't what they want, or is this generation less interested in ownership? Let us know what you think. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests, all millennials and all involved in real estate. Ryan Vizda is here. She's a realtor in Concord, co-owner and founder of the Vizda team with Keller Williams. Nick Reagan is here, realtor in Bedford with the On the Move Realty Group, and Heather McCann, director of housing research at the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority. And Heather, I know you wanted to jump in just on some of the points that Ryan was making just before the break.
Yes, so Ryan made a great point about how there aren't many new homes being built. So when we're talking about the supply issue, that plays a major factor. And so I just wanted to point out that we track the single-family permits. And so annually, we took an annual average of the permits before the recession and after. And
so building permits.
Yes, correct. And so we're about half of where we were prior to the recession. So it just, the building hasn't made it back up to where we were. And at in our organization, we always refer to the five L's, or the impediments to building, which are the cost of lumber, finding labor, loans, land and laws. And so the land and laws kind of go hand in hand. And when we talk about that, we're talking about land use regulations within towns and municipalities. And so we work with a lot of towns to look at their local regulations to how to open that up to make building more feasible.
Planning boards and zoning boards and so forth, and how much housing they allow to be built.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to jump in too, Nick?
Yeah. You just made a great point where we have the older generation that may have more liquid assets that are looking to purchase. You know, maybe they're downsizing, their kids have moved out, versus a new home buyer. So I was hosting an open house just like 2-3 weeks ago, single family home in Manchester, single level ranch, you know, one level living. And I did notice that there was a lot of folks coming through that property that were like, oh, well, we're looking to downsize. You know, our son just went off to college 2 years ago and, you know, he's out in Sacramento, so we don't need this, you know, 3,500 square foot house anymore. So, you know, if they were to put in an offer, you know, if you ask them about financing, they're like, oh, well, you know, we'd be paying cash for this property. And so it, and this was, you know, exactly in that price point, it was sub 300. And, you know, that it just rang a bell with me, because I know that I see it firsthand all the time. And I even spoke to these people about new construction, and they're like, you know, we really like this area. I don't even remember where it was. It was not too far from where I was. They're like, but all the new homes are multi-level and we're looking for a single level. So I was like, well, you know, so then that got us on this exact same topic of like, well, why aren't these builders building single level? But that's not where apparently the profit is, because they're looking at the same thing as you guys of, you know, how much the land's costing them versus the labor and the land and all that stuff. And it's, you know, possibly just not feasible to sell that house for that little money when they're, you know, they need an acre minimum, they need all this other stuff because it's not a city lot and stuff like that. So that was a great point.
Toward those bigger homes that you mentioned, Nick, and it's so interesting because when I see homes for sale around Concord, a lot of them are these big homes. You know, people had 2-3 kids and then the kids go off, and so they don't want that big home. I just wonder, Heather, is anybody talking about taking those big homes and dividing them up so that you can have smaller homes, but still, you know, nice houses near amenities that you want and so forth? Otherwise, they're just kind of sitting there empty.
Right. Well, there has been a lot of talk based on the new ADU law that just passed, I think last year. And so that gives people the opportunity to maybe convert a space either in their home or not attached or detached, depending on what's allowed, to either have maybe their parents live in a bigger house with
them. The so-called mother-in-law apartment.
Yeah, and share that space to make it more affordable for maybe somebody looking to get into their first home or to rent it. There isn't a ton of houses available that maybe have in-laws that can help offset that cost. So I think it's a good option. And I don't know how many millennials actually are aware of the law and doing that work to make it more feasible for them to afford a big home.
Ryan, what are your thoughts on Heather's five L's and why the housing market, you know, regular supply and demand, isn't giving this group of home buyers what it wants?
Because you make more money in the luxury side of construction. It costs the same amount to build a luxury house, just the base of it, as it is to build an affordable house. However, with the finishes and the customization, the builder makes more. So the profit margins are slimmer on affordable housing. And most communities will welcome a luxury house versus affordable workforce housing. They think that it's an impact on the schools and that it's going to bring the community down. And what they forget is that our workforce are our teachers, the people that work at the post office, at the grocery store, at our restaurants. There's a stigma attached to our workforce, but we need our workforce to have a vibrant, healthy economy.
What cities and towns, Ryan, do you think seem to be supplying more of what this generation wants? Because I have heard, we've done a lot of shows on this, that housing is a statewide issue, but it also varies a lot town by town.
So definitely Concord has some great developers here that are, I call them stakeholders that care about the culture. So they're working on, in the city as well, has a lot of people that are really invested in this issue. Amherst has a really progressive building code that is supportive towards workforce housing and 55 plus, so you can have more housing in a dense place of land. You know, the Seacoast is very expensive. I know Portsmouth is working on it. However, it's just a tough market because the entry point into Portsmouth is over $700,000.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, to our listeners, and Kelly sent us an email. Kelly says, I'm 25. I live in Concord. My significant other and I pay $1,650 a month in rent for an apartment in Concord. Wow. We've been looking for a home to buy in downtown Concord for a year now. Everything we've looked at under $250,000 needs major maintenance or major renovations. Most affordable homes in Concord simply aren't worth buying. Simply put, we don't have the liquid assets or the time to deal with the strings attached to these homes that haven't been maintained. And I think, Kelly, thank you for the email. That illustrates perfectly what you guys were talking about earlier. One, you can't find anything in your price point. And two, when you do find it, it needs major expensive repairs. So, Kelly, thank you for sharing your story. Let's go to our callers. And Pat's calling in from Conway. Hi, Pat. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to call to address the down payment issue. I actually am a mortgage banker, so I'm very familiar with the issues that people have trying to get into a home. There are programs that allow for no down payment, minimal down payment. We actually are the only company in the nation. We've partnered with Fannie Mae, where we have a program that it's great for millennials because they're very tech savvy and they love doing this. But we help them design a web page. It's like it's called Home Fund It, and it's like a GoFundMe page. And that way, their friends, family, and things can make small donations to that fund, and it goes directly towards their down payment and closing costs. So they can come up with money that way to do all sorts of things and to get the down payment or the closing costs that they need, because it can be used towards anything.
So you're pushing back also on the narrative, and Nick did this too, Pat, that you need 20% for a down payment. You're saying not so.
No, and that is actually, it's not a myth about the 20% down. I'm probably older than all of your guests, and when my parents bought their house, there were no loans that you could get to buy a house for more than 80% loan to value. You had to put 20% down, and that obviously has changed over the years. But some people they pass that down to their kids and their grandkids because they've heard all the horror stories about, oh, this is a bad loan or that's a bad loan. And we know if you go 20% down, you'll be safe. You won't get into something scary.
Well, and Pat, after what we saw in the recession with some of these shady, you know, mortgage products, it's hard to blame millennials for being cautious. Maybe it's good that they're cautious when it comes to, you know, not jumping into a home that maybe they can't afford.
I totally agree with you about that. I do believe that, like anything, there are people who are good at their job and there are people that are not so good. And what people need to do is they need to make sure that whoever they work with spends all the time that's needed to make sure they're 100% comfortable, to answer the questions, even if they're answering the same question 6 or 7 times. It doesn't mean that the buyer doesn't get it. It means the person explaining it hasn't explained it well enough so that they get it.
Well, and I remember buying my first home, I'm sure I asked them to explain it at least 3 times. So it is confusing. Do you want to jump in, Ryan?
Yes. One of the things that I like to tell first-time home buyers is when you're looking for your lender and your real estate professional, you want somebody that understands what you want to spend on the monthly. What is your budget for this house, for the principal, interest, taxes, and insurance? And then what can you budget for utilities? And then rule of thumb, $2 per square foot per year just to keep the house in the same condition it's currently in. So factor that into your purchasing and then find a lender that you tell them, I want to spend $1,600 no more on my pity. And every single house, run that house by the lender, have them do the cash flow. And if you're comfortable with it, then we go and see it. That way you're not, you mean, you could be pre-approved for $400,000, but that monthly doesn't feel comfortable to you and it's not going to be comfortable to you in 6 months or a year. And I'd rather have you call me in a couple years saying, I've built some equity here, I'm ready to upgrade or, you know, do a second purchase versus I need to short sell or I need to get out of here right away because I can't live here any longer.
Pat, thank you for the call. And let's take another one. This is Josh in Manchester. Hi, Josh. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I had a question, I guess, kind of regarding the financial risk. So one of the challenges for me and my wife, and we're both in our mid-30s here, is, you know, overcoming that, well, you know, when you buy a house, you do have closing costs, and, you know, there's other things that are kind of nested into that. It's not just, you know, I like we're just going through those, all the different numbers that factor in. But, you know, there is a trade-off, right, between renting. There's a, you know, number of years where you're going to break even owning your home. And some of that, you know, is a function of what the economy is doing and the market's doing, because you might buy high and sell low. But even ignoring that, I'm curious, what's the current thinking for how long the break even is for owning versus renting?
Sure.
Because millennials, you know, we don't necessarily, you know, we don't know how long we're going to stay at the current job or if we're going to have kids or, you know, if we like the town. There's definitely a lot of uncertainty in the generation as a whole. So,
sure,
you know,
it's a time of transition in your life.
One little question nested with a big comment there.
Well, and if I could ask you, Josh, do you own or rent? You said you're in your 30s, so...
Yeah, no, we own a home. We bought a condo in our mid-20s and then switched to a house a couple of years ago, actually in the same town, and we're down in Limeboro.
Okay. Thank you very much for calling in. We appreciate it. Nick, what do you think? You can't answer the specifics of his situation, but this whole idea of does it pay off? Do you make money? Is there a break-even point? I just wonder what kind of questions you get from people that you work with about whether this investment is worth it.
Yeah, so I mean, I have that discussion with myself on the daily basis. Is it worth it when I walk out of my house and I got, you know, I got a chore to do? Because
right.
I mean, that's a trade-off as well over renting. But you know, in the long run, I mean, like he said, if you buy high and you sell low, I mean, you just have to just average it out. I mean, it's all going to depend. Obviously, it is a risk of purchasing, and if you are able to stay, you know, you can just ride out that trending change. If it's going down, you know, eventually it's going to come back up. We obviously don't know when it's going to come back up at that time. But if you're able to to stay. But otherwise, you obviously would have to cut your losses and leave if, say, you had a job change or, you know, you had to move across the country or, you know, you outgrew the house and there was no option to stay. So it's a very tough question to answer. I mean, I definitely think that real estate is a safe investment and it is a great investment. I mean, if the worst comes to worst, you could always just rent that property if it's at a time when the market is low and you could ride out the wave that way.
Especially here in New Hampshire where the rental vacancy rates are almost zero in some communities. Yeah, go ahead, Heather.
I just wanted to share my story in terms of the break-even point. And then going back to Ryan's point of older homes. So my husband and I wanted to get back into the neighborhood that I grew up in as a kid, and it just wasn't affordable. So we actually bought a foreclosure that was vacant on the market. It was in terrible shape. And we did a rehab loan, and we rehabbed it and literally replaced everything major that you could replace. And so we came out of that with a lot of equity. And so that was something post-recession that my husband was really, he's like, I don't want to buy a home for $300,000 and owe $300,000 on a home. So he was very weary of that. And so it was a way to kind of make sure that we weren't going to be upside down on a home. And so it's a very long process. I think it took us about 7 months to complete before we could move in. But it's another option that people that are having some concerns of maybe break-even points and if it's worth it to consider.
Well, and Ryan, I wonder how much your generation's coming of age during the recession, during the housing crash, shapes their thoughts and maybe even their fears around home ownership because they have seen firsthand what can happen when the housing market crashes.
I think that's one of the reasons why people are holding off and they're renting. And I found that once we quickly move away from this single family mentality, a lot of the first time home buyers I work with, I can get them to understand that a multifamily purchase makes more sense for them. I've helped 17 first time home buyers buy multifamilies over the last year. And
so is that like typically a duplex? I mean, I'm sure
duplex,
every situation is different,
but family.
You live in one side and you rent
Correct.
It out to the other
and
person.
One of the greatest joys I have is when we leave the closing table and they've calculated and they're like, I'm going from $1,600 a month in rent to maybe $300 or $600, $900 a month to own because the other person or the other two people are paying my mortgage.
Because you're renting out the other half of your house.
Correct.
Yeah, although then you do have to sign up to be a landlord, find the right people, make sure they don't do things that they're not supposed
with
to do.
Less than 1% vacancy
everything's a trade-off.
Rate,
yeah.
You put a sign in. I just had clients close last week and they put their rental posting up. And actually, I thought they were pricing it a little high for a two-bedroom. They've had 15 applications in less than 12 hours.
Wow.
Just
okay.
On Craigslist.
Well, lots of emails coming in from our listeners, and I'd love to share some of them with you. Courtney says, I just wanted to say that I and my husband are millennials. We bought our first home in Manchester in 2013 for $180,000 with 3.5% down. So that's that small down payment that we talked about. And now we feel really stuck, Courtney says. This three-bedroom, one-bathroom, 1,250-square-foot house that was supposed to be our five-year home is looking a lot more like 10 or 15-year home because childcare for two kids is astronomically expensive. Student loans are equal to what we spend in our mortgage. And any house that we think we could afford really isn't any better than the house we already live in. It can be discouraging. So, Courtney, thank you for sharing your story. And we'll hear a lot more stories after a short break. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email like Courtney did. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. More on millennial home ownership in the Granite State in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Join host Peter Biello for all the state news you might have missed. That's tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today, millennial home ownership in the Granite State, what this group of potential home buyers wants, and why it seems so hard for them to get it. Let's get you into our conversation. We'd love your stories, your perspectives on this. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Ryan Vizda, realtor in Concord, co-owner and founder of the Vizda Team with Keller Williams, Nick Reagan, realtor in Bedford with the On the Move Realty Group, and Heather McCann, director of housing research at the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority. And all of you, right back to our listeners. Otto sent us a note. He says, my brother and I pooled our money together last September to buy a house in Somersworth. I graduated from college in May 2017. My brother graduated the next year. We made the choice after we both knew we wanted to stay in New Hampshire and found that rent for a one-bedroom apartment would exceed a mortgage payment, especially since we have dogs. We put 3% down. There's that 3% number again. Got a three-bedroom house with a barn. It needs a little work, but it's stuff we can learn. And rent out a room to pay for making improvements. We're 5 minutes from downtown Dover, 30 minutes from downtown Portsmouth, and have a decent yard. Side question, how does one need to pay for mortgage insurance to go away? I want to comment on Otto's situation first, though, because I've read about this in some of the numbers that we heard from the Urban Institute earlier, and anybody can comment on this, that yes, when people get married, they typically, that's when they buy a home, but that we are seeing more single people buying homes and more just friends buying homes, brothers buying homes like Otto. What do you think? Heather, I'll turn to you on this.
I think it's a great option, especially I know a couple of friends that have bought homes as a single person and have rented rooms out to people and it's gone well, especially they knew that they wanted the home for a while. They were single. They felt they could grow into it over time. And until then, you know, you can rent out some bedrooms if you're comfortable doing that. And I think it's a great option of looking at kind of different solutions and opportunities in a tough housing market, especially where rents are so expensive.
Interesting. Well, Otto, thank you for the story. And it sounds like he's got a great situation there. Alex writes us, he says, I'm a millennial on the planning board in my town. The rest of the members of the board are older and specifically do not want younger families to move to the community, Alex says. The laws and regulations regarding plot size and such are openly intended to prevent affordable homes from being built. They don't want more children in our school district because of the fear of taxes being raised. Alex says, if the state funded the school system better, there would be less fear of taxes being risen, and I might finally get some traction in changing the mindset of my fellow board members. What do you think about this? Ryan, I'll turn to you. We have been talking about this in New Hampshire for a long time. Mm-hmm. I am surprised, given the demographic challenges, given the workforce challenges that we talk about almost every single day, that people still feel this way. No young people.
First off, Alex, thank you for serving in this capacity. We need more young people to sit on these boards to help break the stigma that you're up against. Second, I think that people forget that people with families spend money in communities, which actually helps everybody. They're not just coming to a community to suck the life out of the town. It just totally behooves me that people think that kids coming into a community hurts a community, especially in our state where the average age is, I don't know what it is, but I know it's high. It's not family
age. It's about 42.
Correct. Yeah, like we need more young people here to have a more vibrant community. And I agree, the way that property taxes are structured, it does hurt this type of development. And I think this is one of those things that we need to change, because if we're going to have a vibrant and sustainable, you know, New Hampshire that has a very vibrant workforce, we need more housing that is diverse and is accessible for young people and even older people as they downsize.
Well, and speaking of housing diversity, I did want to ask all of you about the tiny house trend. Mm-hmm. I've read a lot about this. It seems to be very popular in other parts of the country. I have not seen this taking off here in New Hampshire. Ryan, anybody, do you know about the availability of tiny houses here in the state?
It's tough because, well, I saw the draft of the bill that went to legislation before it turned into a study, and it was very loose on the language around regulations of the water systems and septic. So I think we need to kind of when they do this study, they definitely have to be more creative and thinking about how is are we thinking tiny houses that are mobile or just small homes on smaller lots, and are we going to change the standards of what we're looking at for a well and septic, or can there be lots sharing a septic, sharing a well? Like, there has to be more creative thinking, because that's what we're up against with tiny houses.
Have you sold any tiny houses, Nick, in your area?
I have not sold any tiny houses.
Are there any tiny houses in your area?
I have not seen a tiny house for sale.
Okay, because I hear about this, you know, everywhere, but it does always seem to be in other parts of the country. So, Heather, any thoughts there?
I know that there was, back to Ryan's point, challenges with trying to make things work in New Hampshire, especially if it's mobile. And so I think there's some sorting out some issues with that and trying to make something work. I think people always think millennials want a tiny home. And then back to Ryan's point earlier, I think there may be a group that would be interested, but not everybody wants a tiny home. So I think it would serve a specific group of people. And I think it's good to think of different types of housing. We should have a wide variety of housing in the state for people to choose from and not just these big four-bedroom homes.
Well, and one of you mentioned earlier, you know, the assumption is, or the image of millennial homebuyers is that they all want small houses walking distance to downtown. And I think one of you said earlier, not necessarily. Some people want to not see neighbors and be able to grow their own food. By the way, on the tiny houses, and I know it's sort of on hold here in New Hampshire, this is a topic that we will cover down the road, at least one show, if not two. So listeners, if you have thoughts or experiences with the tiny house topic, you can send them into exchange@nhpr.org. Alex wrote us a note. Alex says, I'm a millennial working in the lending industry. I know the ins and outs of all my possible finance options, and I have a decent amount set aside in my 401k when the time came to buy a home. Still, there was, Alex says, no way I could have purchased a home on my own. Honestly, I lived with my parents and just saved money, which was embarrassing. Eventually, I found the right person, and it wasn't until she and I got married that we could afford to buy our first home. Alex says, I had everything going for me, a good job, great credit, some money set aside, knowledge of the whole process. None of it mattered. It takes at least two people to afford an apartment, let alone a house. I don't know how any of my peers could possibly do it on their own. Alex, thank you so much for that call. And he mentions his parents. Now, it sounds like he didn't get help paying for a house from his parents. But I have read, and I wonder what you guys think, maybe you, Nick, how much help millennials are getting from their parents. I read about a trend called co-buying, for example.
So, I mean, yeah, instead of co-signing, they basically just co-buy it. So it's like a car loan. If you don't have the credit, you essentially co-sign, like you guarantee that loan. But when you purchase a home, you co-buy it. So basically they're on title, they're on the financing, but not necessarily the title. There was a good point that he made there regarding multiple people being able to afford a house. So I just recently closed on a property. The current owners rented it back, and so they just charged them 1 month of their mortgage. So after, you know, all the papers were signed and everything and everyone was gone, I left with my sellers, and they're like, how are these folks going to afford this? Like, because these people are retired on a fixed income. You know, they had good jobs, good careers, and they had to cut that check for what would be their mortgage. And they're like, how are they going to afford that? Like, I know that they have good jobs, but that is a lot of money. And I was just like, I mean, their lender worked it out, and we have no idea how much money they make, but he just made that comment to me, like, I wouldn't have been able to afford that at their age, kind of thing. So, I mean, it's a great point. I mean, when I bought my house, I bought it with the intentions of having roommates. I 3 years later still have roommates. So
okay. It
just makes life a lot easier.
Well, and you hear the frustration in Alex's email, and I'll turn to you, Ryan, but anybody jump in, just feeling like, you know, he has everything right going on, the job, the good credit and so forth, and still he feels like it's impossible. What sort of sunshine can you shine on this, giving people who are listening a little bit of hope that, yeah, if you get creative, you can do this?
First, I think if you are paying anything over $1,000 a month in rent, just go and speak to a lender today and get pre-approved. That does not mean you're committed to working with that lender. You're not committed to the home buying process, but it will give you the idea of what you need to do to prepare to purchase.
So you're kind of ready to go if
Correct.
You are driving down the road and you see something
right.
fabulous.
Lots of people just pick a purchase price and start shopping on Zillow, and then they want to go see the house, and then they'll get they'll be like, I'll get pre-approved after I find my house. Like, first,
the house is going to be gone by the time you do that in this market.
And I don't even know if you can afford that house. Don't you want to? If you can only afford a Honda Civic, you should not be shopping on a Porsche budget. So that's just, first off, just every millennial out there, just go meet with a lender. Even if you have a bad credit score, they're not going to judge you if they're a great lender. They're actually going to say, okay, here's your 6 months plan, here's your year plan, here's your 2 year plan. Like, here's the plan. You need a plan. So that's one thing. Second, around parents helping, there's also this gift fund. Parents can do a letter that says their child will not have to pay them back. So a lot of people access the property that way. And then there's also the USD ARD loan and the VA loan, which is 0% down. So there are definitely options to access homes.
What kind of financing tools are you working with, Heather, at the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority, especially for younger buyers?
Yeah, so we have a very unique program where we offer cash assistance to buyers to help with their down payment and closing costs. We also offer what's called a home buyer tax credit. So every year they can get a credit on their taxes to help make things maybe a little more affordable. We also have home buyer education and resources on our website, which is gonewhampshirehousing.com. So there's some webinars and stuff so they can go through the process and just get a feel for what they might need to get ready for and what it's going to be like. And then for people that maybe have bought a house and could be in over their head, we also have some counseling services, and that's homehelpnewhampshire.org.
Speaking of being in over your head, one study that I looked at from a financial research organization found some buyer's remorse among young adult home buyers. They didn't realize all the expenses associated with homeownership, and some of you have alluded to this earlier. Not just the sticker price, which is easy to see, but the home insurance, the property taxes, the repairs, the upkeep. What do you think, Nick? How well are these factors understood, especially by those younger first-time home buyers?
So
it's not just that monthly mortgage.
Yeah, absolutely not. So, you know, I'll just use myself as an example. When I bought my house, I had no idea like what, you know, the electric bill was going to look like every month. You know, I had a rough idea of like what a new roof might cost and things like that. So, you know, some home inspectors that I actually use, they set a really good precedent of setting that price of being like, they give them like a folder and in that folder, it's like, you know, if the house is equipped with an air conditioner, here's roughly what it'll cost you to replace the air conditioner. Here's roughly what it's going to cost to replace this roof because it's, you know, let's say the roof square footage is 1,800 square feet. It's typically, you know, whatever dollars per square foot. So that way they have like that material right from the beginning.
So it's a reality check.
Exactly. And so, you know, they can read it, but once they got to cut that check for it, you know, obviously it's a little different. But what I always do for all my listings is get like the monthly costs of all their services. So if they have water and sewer, electric and cable, like just so that way these people have an idea like, okay, my mortgage is going to be $1,600. These people, obviously my electric bill is not going to be the same, but these people have been spending $200 a month on electric. These people have been spending, you know, $150 on cable, just to get you a general idea of what it's roughly going to cost you. Because yeah, I mean, that's my number one thing when I'm working with people. Like Ryan had said earlier, I don't care how much you can afford. It's how much you're comfortable paying per month, because that's ultimately what it's going to come down to, is how much you can afford every month. Because like she said, I don't want to get a call in 2 or 3 years that like they're
I'm
shaking
underwater
in the boots because they're underwater. And they can't afford it anymore.
Or they're house poor. They can't afford to,
they can't,
you know,
go on vacation
right,
or buy and, you know, afford to, you know, put their kid in daycare, because obviously, you know, looking forward, you got to think about things like that.
Right.
So
do you want to jump in, Ryan, on how well understood those other factors are, how transparent they are? Whose responsibility is it to make sure that that first-time buyer really gets it's not just about the monthly mortgage? It's about a lot more than that.
Fortunately, it's hard, because I guess one thing we didn't talk about is that the millennial buyer is more internet savvy. So they're actually doing so much research on their own, but they're Googling articles that are very general, like written generally, that are not specific to our market. So even though you can self-inform yourself, please like find a professional that that actually cares about you and cares about what you want to spend. Because if somebody's just trying to sell you something, you can feel that right away. But if somebody really wants to help you, they're going to ask you questions. They're going to ask you about your goals. They're going to ask you about how you want to live. And then they're going to help you achieve that.
Yeah, and a realtor doesn't want to put you in a house that you can't afford because
correct.
That's just a problem
correct.
Down the road. Got an email from Cody who says, I just recently bought a house in Manchester. I split it with friends and we bought a two-family. We're renting out the other apartment, so splitting the mortgage three ways and having the rental income helps keep it affordable. I wonder if your guests have any similar stories of friends going in on an investment. I think, Nick, you said a moment ago that's what you're doing, right?
No, that's just how I bought a house, single family house.
Oh, you bought the house and you're renting it.
That is absolutely a great way to go about it. You know, in the future, if one of these friends, you know, wants to, you know, move on, you know, they find a significant other or they just want to buy their next investment property, you know, it's very easy to get themselves out of that situation. And, you know, it's an awesome way to start out your financial success.
Well, Cody, thank you for the email and good luck to you. And Heather, to you, just last question. What small trends are you noticing right now with this issue here in New Hampshire that you think might develop into bigger trends? What's sort of lurking on the horizon, good or bad?
Well, so one thing that's coming back into light right now is interest rates are dropping. And so I don't know if a lot of people were expecting that, especially millennials, because we had seen them climb up. And I think a lot of people were like, I need to buy a house now before interest rates get so high. And now they're coming back down. So I'm thinking that that is going to give some people a little opportunity to breathe a little bit and say, you know what, I can do my research, do my homework, see what I qualify for. Interest rates are dropping a little bit, and so it's not that big rush to like buy a home before it gets the interest rates get too high for somebody.
Oh, that's interesting. How about you, Ryan? What are you sort of looking at that isn't a big enough trend right now to really talk about it or write about it, but something that you think might start to emerge?
Energy independent construction. Like, we have the knowledge and the concepts on how to build houses that are not dependent on fossil fuel. So why aren't we doing it?
Yeah, how about you, Nick? What are you looking at down the road?
I mean, it's just affordability of you know, our wages going to go up substantially, our purchase price is going to come down. So it's going to be very interesting to see what unfolds.
All right. All of you, thank you very much for being here. Nick Reagan, it was good to meet you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, Laura.
That's Nick Reagan, realtor in Bedford with the On the Move Realty Group. Heather, good to see you. Thank you.
You too. Thanks, Laura.
Heather McCann, Director of Housing Research at the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority. And Ryan Vizda, good to see you too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ryan Vizda, realtor in Concord, co-owner and founder of the Vizda team. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.